This morning, we are starting a two-week series that we are calling Heart Check. For the next 2 weeks, we're going to be doing a heart check. It's so that we're all on the same page when we talk about the heart. We're using kind of the Greek understanding, which would have been what would have been the case in the ministry of Jesus when he talks about the heart. Greek word there, cardia. And when it talks about the heart in Greek, and I got some tinging going, yeah. It's referring to the center of one's consciousness. It's the rational, moral, emotional makeup. It's the intellect. It's the will. The heart refers to the part of one's being where priorities are set, where decisions are made. When Jesus is talking about the heart, he's talking about that decision-making place, the priority-setting place. And so this morning, that's what we're going to be checking. We're going to be checking our heart. We're going to be checking the priority-setting, the decision-making part of who we are. In order to do that, we're going to talk about money. We're going to talk about money a lot. If you're a visitor here this morning, we might have just affirmed all of your suspicions that all the church does is talk about money and all we want is more of your cash. That's not the intent of the sermon. We're here to do a heart check. It just so happens that one of the things that reveals the condition of a heart is how one uses or prioritizes regarding money. Now, as covenanters, one of the questions we ask is, where is it written? So you should be feeling completely free to go, hey, where is that written? Well, at least a third of the parables of Jesus deal with the issue of money. You read through the teachings of Jesus, and he talks about money all the time. He talks about money more than he talks about sexuality. He talks about it more than he talks about politics. He talks about money more than he talks about just about anything. If you just add up, the one thing that he talks about time and time again is money. Because Jesus understood that how we deal with money impacts our heart, and what he was after was a heart. This morning, I will repeatedly come back to, what is this saying about your heart? I guarantee I will offend most of you this morning. I double guarantee that every one of you at some point this morning is going to feel very defensive. I don't apologize for that. It's on purpose. And when you feel those emotional responses this morning, have the courage to do some self-examination. Why am I feeling like that? What does this say about my heart? What does this say about how I prioritize? What does this say about my making God Lord of my life? So when you feel those emotional responses this morning, may you have the courage to risk some self-examination. Jesus talks about money throughout the Gospels. He says things like, no one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Jesus understood a heart divided is not a whole heart. Check that math out. And he said to them, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his or her possessions. And then the one that you're probably most familiar with out of Matthew 6, do not lay up for yourselves. Some of your Bibles might say, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Jesus is very clear that how we deal with possessions directly impacts the condition of our hearts. Where your treasure is, where you set your priorities, impacts the condition of your heart. Look, let's just assume that we go to the doctor, and we go to a doctor, and we have the doctor run a series of tests on the condition of our physical heart. And after this battery of tests, the doctor comes into the room, looks at you, and says, I have some concerns about the physical condition of your heart. One, that should alarm us. Okay, not good. And inside, we should be asking, okay, what steps do I need to take, doc, for me to have a healthier heart? And this doctor says, well, he might say, you need to change some of your lifestyle choices, how you exercise, the things you eat. Perhaps the doctor would prescribe some medicine. This medicine would be very useful for you to move from an unhealthy to a more healthy heart. Or maybe the doctor would look at you and say, we are recommending surgery, that we go in and do something physical to your heart because your heart is in bad shape. To get it to a healthy place, these are the steps that we are prescribing. How foolish of us if we looked at the doctor and said, no thanks, I'm going to have another deep fried Twinkie. Unfortunately, this is what we say to Jesus all the time. Jesus looks at the condition of our hearts and he goes, I am concerned for the condition of your heart. And I am prescribing certain things for you to do. Lifestyle changes. Start taking on some other things. And our response to Jesus is usually, I would like a second opinion. Because the way that Dr. God is prescribing me to move forward is unreasonable. Who is God to think he knows what's best for me? He's just the one that designed me and created me. He actually knows what is best for my life, for the condition of my heart, and so he prescribes a certain way to live. But we always want a second opinion. Joyce Meyer, in one of her writings, said this: as Christians, we need to check our hearts a lot more often, because many times Christians can go through the motions and keep doing the Christian thing, but something has crept in their hearts and is hurting them and others. Proverbs 4:23 says, guard your heart above all else, for it determines the course of your life. Notice that it doesn't say somebody else will guard your heart. It doesn't say God will guard your heart. Your neighbor will guard your heart, or your pastor will guard your heart. It says you need to guard your heart. The question becomes, how? How do we guard our heart? How do we make sure that our heart is in the place that is truly healthy? And Dr. God gives a single word as a prescription for a healthy heart. And that word is tithe. Tithe. Boy, if you ever want to get a church dead quiet, you could, I heard the cricket across the street after I said the word tithe. But he used that word tithe, or tithing. And that's a scary word for a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. Here's two words on tithing that might help just give an overview of what tithing is about. Tithing is about generosity and obedience. Tithing is about generosity and obedience, about having a spirit of generosity, being willing to give and give and give. But it's also an issue of obedience. In fact, I've gotten to the point personally, when I see the word tithe, I try to mentally and intentionally just switch out the word tithe and put in obedience. Because that's what it is. God has said, do this. In fact, he doesn't say, here's a suggestion for you if you're feeling up to it. That's not how God puts it. He goes, tithe. If you told your child to go upstairs and clean their room, and the child went upstairs and a few moments later came back down and said, I made my bed. You might think, well, I'm glad that's moving in the right direction. Did they obey?
No, they didn't. They were disobedient. They were told to clean their room. They didn't. In that moment, they chose to disobey. I'm going to do a variety of instead of what I have been told to do by my parent. But this is exactly how we approach the idea of tithing. God says tithe. I made my bed. Good. I mean, that's a good thing. We're moving in the right direction. But God goes, you have a heart condition, and I have not just the diagnosis, but the prescription for you. This will lead to a healthy heart. I made my bed. John Ortberg, he's one of my favorite writers and speakers. He said, the word tithe means a tenth part. Tithing means 10%. For Israel, however, tithing was really only a start. If you read through your Old Testament, you'll see that there are at least three different types of tithes that are mentioned. So for ancient Israel, if you're just going to play the math game, it's probably closer to 23% than 10%. I've heard it said this way, and I really appreciate it. Tithing is a great floor. It's a lousy ceiling. It's a great floor. It's a lousy ceiling. How many of you have heard the name Dave Ramsey? Financial Peace University. He says a lot of really good things that help people work with resources in a way that's honoring to God. And as he writes, he says, the tithe, which is a scriptural mandate, was not instituted for God's benefit because he already has all the money he needs. He does not need our money. But then he goes on to say, so why does he ask us to give him 10%? Tithing was created for our benefit. It is to teach us how to keep God first in our lives and how to be unselfish people. God doesn't need your money. He's got it all. He goes, no, I want you to do this. It's for your benefit. I am prescribing a way that's going to be good for your heart. This is my prescription for you. I hear Christians sometimes when talking about the issue of tithing, Christians like to point out, well, guess what? It doesn't talk about tithing much at all in the New Testament. That's the old law. That's Old Testament law stuff. We live under the new covenant. The tithe does not apply to us. I was reading this person named Tammy Milbourne. I go, ooh, I loved how she put it in response to the, oh, that's the Old Testament. That's the law. We live under the new covenant. Tithing is not about the law, she writes. Tithing was before the law, as demonstrated by Abraham. Tithing was endorsed by Jesus in the New Testament, Matthew 23:23. Tithing is a universal principle that acknowledges ownership. It is found in many cultures worldwide and all throughout history, not just under Moses. Most of the people I know that teach grace giving say that that means you give much more than 10%, but ironically, most of them give much less. Bashing tithing for many is just a theological loophole to keep what belongs to God. If you're still wrestling with, well, the New Testament doesn't say much about tithing, what do we do with that? Richard Foster is probably best known for his book, Celebration of Discipline. It's one of the classic books for working through the classic spiritual disciplines. But he also has a book called The Freedom of Simplicity. And in the book, The Freedom of Simplicity, he says, Jesus Christ and all the writers of the New Testament call us to break free of mammon lust and to live in joyous trust. And yet, none of the New Testament writers ever made the tithe the basis for Christian giving. Why did Jesus, Paul, and the apostles refrain from making use of that well-established biblical tradition? The tithe simply is not a sufficiently radical concept to embody the carefree unconcern for possessions that marks life in the kingdom of God. Jesus is the Lord of all, not just 10%. And he goes on to say this, no doubt you noted that Jesus did not condemn the tithe as such. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. The tithe is not necessarily evil. It simply cannot provide sufficient base for Jesus' call to carefree unconcern over provisions. It fails to dethrone the rival god of materialism. If you want to play the math game and go, hey, Old Testament, boy, oh boy, that's 10%. I'm a New Testament person. I don't have to pay attention to the tithe. You want to play the math game? You lose, or maybe you win. You can get caught up in the percentages, 10%, when Jesus is calling for all. The Shema makes it very clear. What's the greatest commandment? To love the Lord, the God, with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. All. But the 10% is an important discipline. And God makes it abundantly clear over and over again. It says something about your heart. And as I mentioned, if so far this morning you've already been made a little uncomfortable, ask yourself the hard question. What is this saying about your heart? And by the way, if I make eye contact with you this morning, it's not because I know something specific. It really isn't. I just kind of like to look around. But as you feel uncomfortable, why? What is it saying about you? Truth be told, tithing in the United States is not a super healthy practice. Studies show this, that tithers make up only 10 to 25% of a normal congregation. Let's just say we're a normal congregation. Calling us normal, well, yeah. But let's say those statistics apply to us, which means 25% of the members of this church tithe. You need to know, I have no idea how much any of you give. I have no idea. I don't count the offering. I don't check the results. I know how much we give as a group. I have no idea what any individual here gives outside of my wife and I. But I'm probably safe to assume that 10 to 25% of our congregation tithes. Only 5% of the U.S. tithes, with 80% of Americans only giving 2% of their income. Christians are only given at a 2.5% per capita, while during the Great Depression, they gave at a 3.3% rate. That statistic should just be very depressing. That during the Great Depression of the 1930s, Christians gave a higher percentage than they do now. Now, these statistics are not intended to be the big guilt hammer, but they should alert us to certain realities. And if you're feeling a little sheepish right now, again, I ask, what is this saying about your heart? I was speaking at a church last night, and I was talking to the pastor beforehand, and I said, you know, the sermon I'm preaching tomorrow morning is one of those shoelace sermons. And he goes, what do you mean? I go, there's going to be a whole lot of people that do this. But yeah, we're praying. Let's just go with that. We'll get to praying in a little bit. Don't worry. Have you ever stopped and wondered what the world would look like if the Christians in the United States specifically tithed? Studies have shown that if all of the Christians, self-professed Christians in the United States, actually tithed, there would be an additional $165 billion made available to be used in and through the church. That was billion with a B. Do you know what could be accomplished with $165 billion to be used by the church for the glory of God? $25 billion could relieve global hunger, starvation, and deaths from preventable diseases in 5 years. $12 billion could eliminate illiteracy in 5 years. $15 billion could solve the world's water and sanitation issues. $1 billion could fully fund all overseas missions work. Steve's over here going, woohoo! And that would mean there's still $100 billion left over. Now, I've heard some people say, well, those studies are a little off. The actual amount is actually only about $80 billion more. Okay, there's still surplus. There's still money left over if the people of God followed the prescription given by God. Sometimes we look at the world around us and we wonder how God could let it happen. We look at all the pain and the suffering in the world around us and go, how can you let this keep going, God? You say you love the world, for God so loved the world. And yet, look at all the pain. Look at all the suffering. We shake a fist at God and go, God, why are you letting this continue? And you can almost hear God go, I was about to ask you the same question. I've given you the means to care for a hurting world. And you've decided to gorge on Twinkies instead. I've given you the prescription. I've given you the answer to your question. And you continually choose another way. Over the years working with students and families, one of my favorite things to talk about was issues of love, sex, and dating. I always just love talking on that topic. And one of the things that I would routinely tell young people when it came to love, sex, and dating was, just let's pretend there's no such thing as God. Let's just pretend no such thing as God. There's no heaven afterwards. When you die, you're worm food. Let's just pretend that that's the reality. If that was the reality, I would still recommend the scriptural description of what a healthy relationship looks like. The way we are to engage with one another relationally, sexually, the healthiest way is the way it's prescribed by the Bible. Even if there was no God, it's still the best way to go about relationships. I'd say the exact same thing about money. Let's say there's no God. Let's say you die, it's worm food time. I would still recommend the scriptural mandate regarding how we deal with our possessions, because it is the healthiest way for our hearts and our minds and our lives and for our world. But we ask for a second opinion. I mentioned earlier that there's going to come a time during the sermon when you're going to feel very defensive, maybe upset. If it hasn't already happened, get ready. It's about to. How we give reveals something about our heart. How we give reveals something about our heart. As you get defensive here in a few moments, risk asking the question, what is this saying about my heart? Designated giving. Most churches will have a general budget, general fund, and then there'll be a whole bunch of specific ministry projects and such, designated projects. Why? There are two types of people that give to designated funds in a church. There are the people that tithe, that give 10%, and then they give to designated accounts on top of that. To those people, keep going. The model, the way you are giving is following a biblical model. But there's a second group of people that they don't tithe and they give to designated accounts. Why? Does it spread their money out, or is it control? I gave the statistics of if everybody in the United States tithed, what that would mean. The same concept exists in the church. Do you realize that if every member of this church tithed, we would have no need for any designated accounts? We would never have to take an additional offering for anything, because we would have more than enough to provide for all of the ministries that we deem are important. We do the Agape Fund, which is a tremendous ministry. The Agape Fund, all the money that goes into the Agape Fund, we give away. It's fantastic, and I got news for you. If every person that is a member of this church tithed, we'd have no reason to ever take an additional Agape Fund offering, because the Agape Fund would be more full than it's ever been. Later on in the service, during the offering, we're going to talk about one of the projects we have where we are going to be getting Christmas gifts for missionaries that we support. It's a wonderful ministry. if we all tithed, we'd have no reason to do that extra thing because the missions team would have all the money they needed to really bless those missionaries in a really special way. If we tithed, we would have more money than we could ever possibly imagine, and designated accounts go out the window. If you are like, I give to designated accounts, here's your chance. Risk a little self-examination. Why? Or how about this way of giving? I give at the end of the month when I have extra. Again, I mean, great, but what does it say about your heart? I give when I remember. Because lots of times I just forget. What does it say about your heart? Would your giving, would our giving look different if there was no tax write-off for it? One of my mentors used to say, I wish that there wasn't a tax write-off for giving to the church. He was a pastor of a large church with a ginormous budget, too. And he said, you know, I sometimes wonder the heart behind the gift. Am I getting it to stick it to Uncle Sam? Or are we doing it out of generosity and obedience? Now, hear me now. I think taking the tax write-off is good stewardship. It's the law of the land. Do it. But if there was no tax write-off, would your charitable giving look different? If so, why? What does it say about the heart? Try this one on. Why is it that the way we give to the church is oftentimes different from the way we give to every other ministry or charitable organization? I'll show you what I mean. These are the steps usually taken toward giving to some other ministry or charitable organization. First step, you consider it. You research the organization. You think about it. You talk with your spouse about it. The next step, you pray about it. Then the next step is you make a decision. We're going to support said ministry. And then the fourth step, you set up an automatic deduction from your account electronically to go from your account to the organization. My wife and I were talking about this the other day. And we kind of went, isn't it interesting that the church is the only place that we give like we give here. Every other organization that we support, we do differently. Compassion International, World Vision, we sponsor kids. And so we talked about it and we prayed about it and we made the decision we're going to support Tumaini in Tanzania. And then it's set up that X number of dollars goes out every month to Compassion International. And it goes every month. We made the decision, we prayed about it, we made the decision, and that was our commitment. It goes. By the way, if you go on our website right now, we now have online giving. Couple words on that. Some of you go, no. I like giving in the plate. We're not stopping that. If that's an important part of your worship, great. Keep doing that. We'll get back to that in a moment, though. But for those of you that would find that to be a useful tool, they go, you know, that would help me in my prioritizing. This would help me in being more intentional. This would help me remember. It would help me to be intentional in my commitment. Great. And if you're under the age of 50 in this room, chances are you don't carry a checkbook and you do all of your bill paying that way, and it might be really helpful. But you get some people, no, Mike, that's taking away from a significant moment in worship. And if it's a significant moment of worship for you, great. Again, hard question, self-reflection time. Is it? What was the last time during the offering that you paused as the plate came by and you allowed yourself to be intentionally grateful for the way God has provided for you? What was the last time you go, God, because you are God and I am not, I'm choosing to act in obedience and I gladly do this? Or do you just pass the plate? Now, granted, we could maybe do a better job from up front in helping facilitate that. But if your argument is, no, this is an important part of my worship, my question is it? Or do you like people noticing that you put something in the plate? Jesus talks about that. How we give says something about our heart. And again, this is not about figuring out a way to get more money to the church. It's really about hearts. And so what does the way that you give reveal about your heart? And somebody said it right over there. Oftentimes, how we give reveals our desire for control. I want to control this. I'm afraid, and so I must control. This past summer, most of us watched the Olympic Games. And there would be that moment in the Olympic Games where it's the 100 meter, the 200 meter, and they'll have the camera down at the finish line looking at the runners. And as the runners are running toward the finish line, they got the slow motion, and you notice their face. It's bouncing. It's just and a bunch of the muscles in their body are just kind of and it's just bizarre looking as the muscles just kind of. Here's the reason why. A world-class athlete understands that if you are tensing up, you lose flexibility and speed. A quality runner knows which muscles need to be engaged and which ones need to just bounce. Because as soon as you tighten your fists when you run slower. Watch a little kid someday. Their fists, they're running. But when I got into track, one of the things that track coaches taught me right away was, they just go, Mike, do this. It got me away from holding with a fist, loosened up the hands, and suddenly there's more flexibility. Running with a fist means compromised running. Living with a fist means compromised living. We're supposed to open up our hands when we run. We're supposed to open up our hands when we live. Henry Nouwen, in his book With Open Hands, it's a book on prayer, and the premise of the book is it's very difficult to pray with closed fists. And we're supposed to pray with open hands because only in that moment are we releasing what needs to be released to the Lord and open to receive. When we do this, it compromises our praying. The same can be said for living. Live with a fist, it's compromised. Live with an open hand, it's radically different. One of the prayers in his book is this: Dear God, I am so afraid to open my clenched fists. Who will I be when I have nothing left to hold on to? Who will I be when I stand before you with empty hands? Please help me to gradually open my hands and to discover that I am not what I own, but what you want to give me, and what you want to give me is love, unconditional, everlasting love. We've talked about some difficult things this morning that have probably made you uncomfortable or a little defensive. Okay, keep asking the hard questions. But I'd like to consider, what are some things we can do to move towards health here? There are some people in the church that tithing has been part of their story all along. And I've talked to some of them, and they talk about, well, I can't imagine somebody not doing that. They're missing out on something really, really profound. But there's some people that have been tithing as long as they can remember. There's other people that have kind of incrementally grown towards tithing or are in the process of going in that direction. My wife and I, when we got married, our conclusion was we were too poor to tithe. I was making $5,000 a year. I think she was making $12,000. And we were living in Ventura, California. And so our conclusion was we were too poor to tithe. And it was a huge mistake because habits were established and priorities that were set and decisions that were made. And as a result, throughout our marriage, we had to learn how to get to the place where we were tithing. And there's some people, you're probably here this morning, go, man, this is just a radical idea that I've never even considered. Okay, we're all in different places about what tithing looks like and the result it has on our lives. And so we're going to give you a suggestion today for some steps to move forward. Interestingly enough, this is not what we're doing. There are a number of churches out there now that are doing what they're calling the 90-day challenge. Have you heard of this? Where they're challenging the people in their church to tithe for 90 days. And if after 90 days, they don't see the benefit of it, they can get a full money refund. Now, we kind of laugh at it, but you guess what? No pun intended here, but I guess they put their money where their mouth is. They go, we're so convinced that the way of God is the best way for you to live, you're going to discover that. Wow. Not what we're doing right away. What we are going to be doing, and this was taken out of a book called Bounty that came out a couple years ago, these three categories, and I really appreciated them, is three steps to a healthier heart. And so our three steps to a healthier heart are going to look like this. Step number one, gratitude. intentionally practicing gratitude. In A.A. Milne's Winnie the Pooh, he writes, Piglet noticed that even though he had a very small heart, it could hold a rather large amount of gratitude. It's a great line. Rather large amount of gratitude. If you are reading the Psalms, you will notice that many of the Psalms have a subtitle underneath them that give instruction for the setting for that Psalm to be read or used. Psalm 100 is one of those. Because in Psalm 100, it says underneath that it is a psalm for giving grateful praise. Listen to Psalm 100. Shout for joy to the Lord, all the earth. Worship the Lord with gladness. Come before him with joyful songs. Know that the Lord is God. It is he who made us, and we are his. We are the people. We are his people, the sheep of his pasture. Enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. Give thanks to him and praise his name, for the Lord is good and his love endures forever. His faithfulness continues through all generations. The first step toward a healthier heart is gratitude. Being intentional about acknowledging where you are thankful. This is why this entire month, we call it the thankfulness experiment. This is why we're doing this, because it's a first step towards a healthy heart. The next step that we're going to be encouraging you to take is this, prayer. Maya Angelou said this, let gratitude be the pillow upon which you kneel to say your nightly prayer. How beautiful a line is that? Let gratitude be the pillow upon which you kneel to say your nightly prayer. We begin with gratitude, and then as we begin our prayers, if we're beginning from a place of gratitude, watch what happens. Chronicles 16 says, look to the Lord and his strength. Seek his face always. Seek his face always. We kneel on that pillow of gratitude and we seek his face. We ask the difficult questions. God, what about my heart needs to be addressed? What are you calling me to do to deal with some of the disease in my heart? Seek his face always. Which then takes us to the third step in this. Faith. Martin Luther King said, take the first step in faith. You don't have to see the whole staircase, just take the first step. In the book of Romans, it says, may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. I love the way Paul puts this, because he says, may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in him, as you take a step of faith. We come to a place where we have to decide, is God God? Is he worth believing in? Do we believe that he is the one that designed us and created us and knows what's best for us? And if so, do we take a step of faith, whatever that step of faith might look like for you? Some of you might be familiar with the name Charles Blondin. Charles Blondin is considered by many to be the greatest tightrope walker in history. On June 30th, 1858, Charles Blondin walked a tightrope across Niagara Falls. During his career, he did such a trip reportedly 300 times. On the first time, the news reported that he went from the American side to the Canadian side. And when he got to the Canadian side, the crowds erupted. It's like, oh. And then he looked at the crowds and goes, do you believe I can make it back? And the crowd's like, woo, we believe. Yeah, woo, we believe. He said, do you believe that I can go back across with someone on my shoulders? And they go, yeah, we believe, we believe. Who would like to be the first? Your response was laughter. Theirs was crickets. And so he started going to individuals. How about you? One of the people was going, oh, I believe. How about you? Mm-hmm. One by one, he started asking people, no, 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 no. Finally, one individual stopped forward. Mr. McDougal, who happened to be his manager. It's like, oh boy, somebody better do this. Mr. McDougal gets up on Charles Blondin's shoulders and they start going across Niagara Falls. About halfway across, the rope began to sway violently. As a result, that the guy wire, which is the wire that keeps the rope in place, had been cut by a gambler that was betting he wouldn't make it. So you got this guy wire that's gone, and the rope is moving. He's got Mr. McDougal up on his shoulders. Midway over Niagara Falls. Whoosh, whoosh. Newspaper reports say, and I don't know how you physically do this, that Mr. McDougal got down off of his shoulders, and they stood there together on the wire. Charles Blondin said this to his manager, "If we are going to make it safely to the other side, you can no longer be Mr. McDougal. You have to become part of me. You can do nothing to try to balance yourself. You have to let me do everything. If you do anything on your own, we will both die. You can no, if we're going to make it to safety, you can no longer be Mr. McDougal. You have to become part of me. You can do nothing to try to balance yourself. You have to let me do everything. If you do anything on your own, we will both die." Reports say that Mr. McDougal got back up onto his shoulders and they continued forward. Mr. McDougal completely trusting the movement of Blondin. And it says that as Blondin got closer and closer to the shore, his speed picked up to the point that he was running with Mr. McDougal on his shoulders to the other side. We can talk about being grateful and spending time in prayer, but there comes a moment where we have to go, will I jump on the shoulders of the Creator? Will I actually trust that He will get me to where I need to go? Where I surrender myself. I have been crucified with Christ, and it is no longer I who lives, but Christ who lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who saved me and loved me. Do we take a step of faith? This next week, I'm going to be encouraging all of us to do a heart check. When you came in this morning, if you were in the front row, it was on your seat. Everybody else, it's in the seat in front of you. Looks like this. Go ahead and grab it. Everybody gets one of these to go home. And it's just a tool to use for this next week to walk you through the process that we've just been talking about. First step on the inside is gratitude. We've been doing the thankfulness experiment. And it's really fantastic. We're going to take it to the next level this next week. And part of the challenge that's written in here is every day this next week, you're going to write 2 thank you cards. 1 thank you card to God, 1 to somebody else. It could be an email. It could be a text. It could be an actual card. But we're going to practice gratitude towards God and for the people in our lives. It helps us. It helps us. The next step is prayer. And what we're encouraging you for 1 week is just take a time each day, set the same time throughout the week to pray. There are a couple of prayers written out. If they're helpful for you, great. There are some suggestions for things to be praying over. Again, if they're helpful, great. Then on the back page is the step of faith. And you'll notice at the bottom, it says, be prepared to answer the following questions prior to Sunday worship. Here's the deal. When you get here next Sunday, I'm not going to be coming up to you and go, how do you answer 4? That's not the intent. But be prepared personally to go, how do I answer these questions? Because how you answer those questions is what you're going to fill out to finish our cross. So these will end up on the cross when you come in, but we won't finish it until during the service next week, as we've spent time for 1 week doing a heart check. I consider it a privilege to be the pastor of this church. I really do. And I recognize that my primary role as pastor is not to be the fundraiser in chief. That's not my primary role. One of my primary roles is to look out for the hearts of a congregation. And I'd be doing a lousy job as your pastor if we didn't wrestle with these difficult things. Because Jesus has made it very clear. Where our treasure is, there our heart is also. And our desire as a congregation is to have hearts that are healthy, that have hearts that are ready to run and enjoy the pleasure of God in ways that we could scarcely imagine with closed fists. Would you pray with me, please?